It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll get a preview of this week's NATO summit, which some are saying could be the most important NATO meeting since the fall of the Soviet Union.
But first, with exactly 9 weeks to go to Election Day, Wisconsin's race for governor is shaping up to be a very close contest between incumbent Scott Walker and challenger Mary Burke.
Polls are showing the two candidates neck and neck among registered voters, among likely voters, making the race one of the tightest campaigns really in the country, also one of the most closely watched.
Candidates are vying for the votes of a small and elusive group of undecided voters in a state with a serious partisan divide. So the question is, what's going to work?
Joining us now is Michael Wagner, assistant professor in the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Mike, welcome.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, a tightly contested race with a serious partisan divide. I know you study partisanship a lot. Is that... we've seen it growing since Act 10, starting a little before that even. Is this just calcifying, really, this intense divide in Wisconsin?
Yeah, a hotly contested, deeply partisan race in Wisconsin is now starting to sound like par for the course. And we're certainly seeing that calcify, as you say, here with about 9 weeks left until the election. There aren't a lot of Republicans or a lot of Democrats who are going to be changing their minds in the next few weeks. And it's the small number of people in the middle who will play an important role, as well as just whether each candidate can get their Republicans and Democrats turned out to the polls on Election Day.
Those are the two big goals. Let's take each of them in turn as far as how the candidates send their message, run their ads. And when I say candidates, I'll throw in the outside groups who are running ads as
right.
Well. First, when it comes to reaching out to that, depending on the poll, 7 to 9% of undecided voters, how do they reach out to those voters?
A heavy barrage of advertising that unfortunately everyone else has to see too, because they can't just target the people who haven't decided in terms of who sees TV ads, but also phone calls, people knocking on doors, anything and everything that they can do to try to contact voters. But mainly the traditional ways of talking to them directly at their doorstep or trying to get them in front of 5 or 6 viewings of the same ad.
And is there an understanding of who the undecided voters are or what they want? Or is this just really a potpourri of people with different reasons for not having picked a side yet?
Well, it's one of those things that's sort of peculiar about democracy, right? We have this small group of people who have the potential to be really determinative with respect to who becomes the governor. And so they're really important. And they don't care so much about politics. They aren't so informed about politics. They aren't so interested in politics. They are not the people in Wisconsin waking up asking themselves, how do I hold my government accountable today? It's the people who are just starting to now pay attention and haven't been living and dying with each Marquette law poll or anything else. And so these folks are less interested, less knowledgeable, and cluing into the race kind of at the last minute. And so it's a different set of people than those who've been talking about this race nonstop for the last several months.
Well, let's look at that other 92% now, half more or less voting on each side of this governor's race. But are we oversimplifying when we say 47% or ish are on the left and they agree carte blanche with everything that the Democrats want, and then the other half, same thing, but for Republicans? Or are they more complicated than we're giving them credit for?
The voters are more complicated than we're giving them credit for. We want to think of them as a left-right divide. Mm-hmm. Liberal Democrats on the left, conservative Republicans on the right. But there's no law that we have to organize our attitudes that way, and most of us don't. But there are issues that each individual, person cares about more than others. And they usually, when they vote, tend to vote in ways that are consistent with the party that sees it their way on that handful of really important issues. So if you're a person who might think of themselves as a conservative or maybe a moderate or somewhere in between, but you really thought Act 10 was a great idea, you're way more likely to vote for Scott Walker. But if you're that same kind of person who didn't like Act 10, Mary Burke is someone who you're going to be paying more attention to and kind of opening yourself up to persuasion from as we get closer to the election.
I don't know if there are ways to measure this, but are we starting to fall more into party lines? Like, there's nothing inherently that says if you are, against abortion, you should be against a minimum wage increase,
right,
too. But are we starting to get more and more in lockstep with what we see as right and on the left?
What's happened over the last 40 years or so is a gradual sorting on the one hand. So it used to be that there were plenty of people who said, I'm a liberal, and also said, I'm a Republican. And there were even more people who said, I'm a conservative, but I'm a Democrat. those people are virtually gone now from American politics. But they haven't been necessarily replaced by a deeply polarized electorate. Some of us are really polarized. Mm-hmm. Other folks are stuck in the middle, but in a way that doesn't give them an obvious choice about who to vote for. So some people are just honest-to-goodness moderates and don't have strong views. Other people are libertarian, so they agree with Republicans on economic issues and Democrats on social issues. And other people are populists, who agree with the Democrats on the economic issues but Republicans on the social issues. And libertarians and populists are just as polarized from each other as liberals are from conservatives. But libertarians and populists don't have a party to vote for because there isn't a party that covers the kind of the panoply of issues that they care about. And so who's a moderate is actually a really diverse group of people who aren't at all alike, which is why it's so hard to appeal to them.
Is the two-party system less representative of that diversity than it used to be? The tents used to be bigger?
The tents, you know, the tents have varied in size, I think, over time. And as new issues come into, you know, the American marketplace of ideas, who is in each tent changes. And so as one party becomes the party of civil rights and the other becomes the party of states' rights or the party of choice or the party of pro-life or the party of pro-gay rights or the party of traditional marriage, like these new issues that have popped up have changed what kinds of people want to be in each party. And for some people, it's really solidified their choice. For those people who are conservative on social issues and conservative economically, the Republican Party is a home for them, and the people who are the opposite of that find an equally comfortable home in the Democratic Party. But not everybody organizes their attitudes that way, and these are the people who split their ticket when they vote, some Republicans, some Democrats. These are people who show up less often at the ballot box and give less money to candidates.
So turning, we talk about the effort to reach out to those undecided voters. You also mentioned the need to get the people you know would vote for you if they voted to the polls. How do the candidates, how do Mary Burke and Scott Walker try to make sure that their people turn out in November?
They first start with lists of voters that are members of their party, and especially those who've supported them in the past, either financially or in some other kind of way. And they start with these lists and just start reminding them, you know, here's where you vote, here's when the election is. And then they also start finding people who are of their party who didn't vote last time, or maybe vote sometimes but not all the time. And so those are the folks who, on the ideas, tend to fit with them, but in terms of showing up on a Tuesday in November, maybe Arnold was with them. And so they try to find those people through public records who are the most likely to be on their side and might need a little nudge to show up. That's where they spend a lot of their resources, especially in the final days of a campaign.
And Democrats are the ones most worried about that turnout in an off-year, a non-presidential election, as
right.
I understand it. Is that right?
That's right. Democrats are typically hurt more in the off-year in terms of their turnout than our Republicans.
So President Obama, in his elections, his campaign was known for some new, innovative, high-tech, first cell phone and texting and social media and things like that. Are Democrats going to be able to maintain that in this off year, or on the other side, have Republicans learned lessons from that to get their people to the polls?
You know, that's a great question. So the Republican Party recognized that they were behind after the 2008 election and saw the machine the Obama campaign put together. And in 2012, the Republicans in some ways caught up to where Obama was in 2008, but then the Obama campaign took it another step, and they started running randomized experiments on undecided voters to find out, well, do voters want to hear our message, or do they want to talk to the caller about what they care about? Which of those strategies works better to convince someone to vote for me? And the Obama campaign learned that it's better to stay on message than give the person on the other end of the phone a microphone. And so they've really improve their ability to target people and figure out how to persuade them. But the Obama campaign and the Democratic Party aren't quite the same thing. And the Obama for America, the organization through which a lot of that campaign was run, hasn't shared all of their lists and all of their strategies in the same way with the Democratic Party as the party might like, which isn't to say they don't help each other. But whether state and local Democrats benefit from the Obama machine is still something that we don't know enough about. And on the Republican side, Governor Walker has a particularly adept turnout machine. And he in particular and the Republican Party in Wisconsin is very good at turning out voters, as they showed in the recall election.
We're talking with Mike Wagner of the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication, looking at the close race for governor. And we'd like to hear from you. Have you been closely watching this race? Are you talking about it all the time. What do you see as each campaign's individual strengths and weaknesses? How well have Mary Burke and Scott Walker branded themselves, if you're watching for that kind of thing? What do you think they have to do to win? Be the pundit here and call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We are talking about the race for governor here in Wisconsin. Labor Day has come and gone. It's the home stretch. 9 weeks from today is Election Day. And looking at what each campaign is trying to accomplish to win over the few undecided voters, to mobilize turnout, and maybe to suppress turnout on the other side. We've got Michael Wagner with us, assistant professor in the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. And maybe we'll hear from you, too, at 800-642-1234. Are you seeing the ads already in your area? What kind of things are you seeing? What do you make of the ads you've seen? 800-642-1234. And we just want to hear your own personal punditry. Handicap this race. What do you think is coming in the next few weeks? 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Mike, I mentioned just there, suppressing voter turnout on the other side. People right. think negative ads, do they really work? Do they work?
Negative ads do some good things. I mean, first of all, hardly anyone will respond to a pollster's question about, do you like negative ads? But yes, yes, I love seeing all this stuff. But negative ads tend to teach people more about the issues in the race and tend to be more memorable and also seem to cause voters to search out more information. Hmm. And so kind of the theoretical background for that is when we're made to feel anxious, we want more information about what's going on to get rid of our anxiety, right? If you hear a rustling in the bushes, you want to see, is that a snake or a rabbit? And if it's a rabbit, you keep moving on. And if it's a snake, you got to figure out what to do. And the same sort of logic applies to how we think about negative ads. Sometimes they'll tell us things that, well, gosh, is that really true about Governor Walker? Is that really true about Mary Burke? And we might be more motivated to talk to people or check out a PolitiFact kind of website or something like that. Negative ads don't do much in terms of stopping or suppressing voter turnout. Typically, if you're motivated enough to vote, hearing bad things about the person you like isn't enough to keep you home.
So but do they really work in terms of, I was going to vote for A, but the negative advertising has convinced me to turn to candidate B?
It's possible for that to work, especially if the information environment is one-sided, which is to say, if one candidate's doing a lot of negative advertising and the other candidate isn't doing much advertising. And so if you want to look for a recent example in Wisconsin, you could think about the Tammy Baldwin-Tommy Thompson race. She was on the air very early with Tommy Thompson, he's not for you anymore. And it took a long time for Thompson to run ads. Once he did, they were negative, but Baldwin had the airwaves to herself for a while, and some think she successfully redefined a pretty popular guy in a way that helped her campaign and helped her win. So it is possible for negative ads to persuade people, but they tend to work best if they're the only people doing the talking.
Talking about the campaign for governor, and we'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Darlene on the line in Viola. Darlene, hi.
Hi there. I would like to know, why is it that we only hear about the Republicans and Democrats and the same old thing that they're always talking about? What happened to the independent party? We need a balance here. There is no balance.
Darlene, thanks for the call. We tend to talk here about the Democrats and Republicans, that they tend to get the bulk of the reporting. Why is that?
Yeah, and that's true across most of the news media more generally, except for maybe the most progressive outlets or the most conservative outlets who might talk about other kinds of minor parties. And one reason that the focus is on the Democrats and Republicans is that when Election Day comes, either Mary Burke or Scott Walker is going to win. And so, of course, the argument on the other side is, well, gee, if maybe these independent candidates could get some attention, they would have a chance to win. But most people tend to vote in a very consistent way, in a way that's consistent with their party identification. And most folks, if you press them, will pick either the Democratic or Republican Party. And the Democrats and Republicans work really hard to keep other parties off the ballot, to keep getting that media coverage, to keep maximizing their chance to win. You're more likely to win a 50-50 race than a 33% race if you're running with three candidates. And so a lot of things conspire to keep minor parties out of public attention. And, you know, it certainly isn't better for democracy that we hear less voices, but it's understandable that the attention goes to the folks who are the most likely to end up serving as governor.
Well, the economy and jobs issues have been the biggest issue, the biggest point of debate in the race so far, and the topic of most ads we've seen.
Right.
Take a listen to an ad from the Scott Walker campaign.
Hi, I'm Scott Walker. Well, the latest job numbers are in, and Wisconsin created more private sector jobs than Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Iowa, Ohio, and Illinois. That means we rank third in the Midwest. Our opponent can try and mislead you and criticize the Wisconsin comeback, but that doesn't change the fact that we're moving Wisconsin forward. We won't stop until everyone who wants a job can find a job.
Yeah, that's Governor Walker's ad, and now let's check out the other side, an ad on behalf of the Mary Burke campaign on job creation.
He made a pledge.
250,000 new jobs by the end of our first term in office.
And asked us to hold him to it.
Is this a campaign promise? Something you want to be held to?
Absolutely.
Today, Wisconsin is dead last in Midwest job growth. 10th out of 10.
Wisconsin lags behind most of the country when it comes to job growth.
And those 250,000 jobs, not even close. Broken promises, dead last in jobs. Scott Walker's not working for you.
Couple things I wanted to get into there, Mike. First of all, the dueling job numbers, we're going to get into this a little with PolitiFact tomorrow at this time, but each of them kind of picking a different starting point in measuring that comparative job growth.
Right. It's the rare case of two candidates for governor both telling the truth, right? So Scott Walker, his ad is accurate. Over the last 12 months, the number of jobs that have been added in Wisconsin compare very favorably to the rest of the Midwest. Now, you could back off and say Wisconsin has more people than a lot of states in the Midwest, so adding more higher numbers isn't necessarily so impressive. But if you look at it in terms of the percentage of jobs we're adding, we still do pretty well. I think it's third, as he said in his ad with numbers, but fourth in terms of overall percentage over the last year. So Governor Walker's telling, you know, a true story there. And Mary Burke is right, too. We do rank dead last in the way that they define job growth over the last several years as compared to the rest of the Midwest. The growth here has been much slower, and the recovery from the recession has been slower here than in other places. And so it depends upon when you want to start, when you think about who's doing a good job with respect to adding jobs or playing a role, at least, in adding jobs for the state of Wisconsin.
Another point I saw made, and I can't remember by whom, but when you can play the other candidate's voice in your ad, as we heard in that Burke ad there with the 250,000 job pledge, is that a particularly effective line of attack?
Well, politicians certainly seem to think so. So you can think back all the way to the 1992 race and then President George H.W. Bush's Read My Lips, No New Taxes from the 1988 race. That got a lot of attention after that promise went unkept. And so when you have a politician's words being, you know, used against them, that can be an effective tactic, because the person sitting at home can say, well, yeah, there is that politician making this argument and they didn't come through. And so maybe that, you know, can be more persuasive. The most persuasive people in ads are regular people. When they're speaking in the camera in political ads, they convince us more than anybody else.
Now, all eyes have been on Wisconsin in the last few years at various points. Act 10 and the protests that surrounded it, the recall election, swing state in the presidential elections. Is our race for governor getting a lot of national attention this time around?
It's getting a ton of national attention for a few reasons. First, if Scott Walker wins, he's vaulted into being a prime candidate for the Republican nomination for president in 2016. Whether he wants it or not, he'll be talked about much more than even already is being talked about right now. But another reason people care is that Wisconsin is a microcosm of competitive executive-level races in swing states. And that matters a lot for the presidency, as our state is almost always one of those kinds of swing states. But it matters a lot for other governor races around the country, because who wins these kinds of races not only control who gets the governor's mansion or electoral votes, but it also helps play a role in controlling who does the redistricting, drawing the lines where members of Congress and state legislators get elected too. And so there's high stakes, and our state is a lot like 10 or 12 others that all play really important roles in national elections.
Bringing it back around to where we started with the issue of increasing partisanship, does the way a race like this is run and paid for, and the issues that we talk about, the way we talk about them, does it tend to harden that partisanship even further?
Yeah, the lion's share of research about elections shows that the closer you get to election day, the more voters come home, which is to say, end up supporting the candidate from their own party. And there's a real calcification of that support for most voters as an election gets closer. Other folks might learn more information about one of the candidates, or others might break to the person they think is going to win. But for most of us, we end up returning back to the political party that brought us to the dance.
All right. Do you see that changing anytime, the partisanship in Wisconsin, anytime soon?
I think we're in a pretty contentious and divided place, and we're probably likely to stay there for the foreseeable future.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was Michael Wagner. He's assistant professor in the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication.